guys are about to listen to TechNet number 1609 of the series that began in September of 1982, 33 or so years ago. The TechNet, as you guys have heard so often, is a gathering of interested people, curious guys who want to know more about wireless technology. How does radio really work? How to make it work better? We teach each other how to do that. Last weekend, was flea market. Here we go. Field day. Any job? I suddenly realized a little bit of what happened last weekend. I intended to visit four different field day sites. I only got a chance to visit three. My first one was Lockfield. They hold their flea market here. Their field day at West High. Here you go. West Hills Park in Huntington. Went there for a couple of hours. Got into some pretty deep conversations. Then I went to Limehawk at the Rose Kennedy School in Wantagh. Stayed there for a few hours and got into some conversations. Also saw some very interesting hardware, like that emergency vehicle that somebody has set up. After that, I went to the Great South Bay Amateur Radio Club, Gisbark, in North Lindenhurst, where they had this 85-foot-high crane with 20 feet or 10 feet of mast sticking out of the top of it with their antennas. A very serious setup. And I was there, let me think, from probably 11 at night until 1:30 in the afternoon the next day, around the clock, if you know what I mean. Altogether, with my visits to field day sites, I was up around the clock. My guess is by Sunday afternoon at Gisbark, I probably was looking a little bit bloodshot eyes, if you know what I mean, when I dropped. One of the conclusions I came to, after thinking back what happened at each of these field day sites, my goodness, is there a thirst for radio knowledge. At each one of these places, a number of guys would gather around and fire questions, and some of them very deep questions that they can do face-to-face that they can't do over the air. Now, some of them represent commercial products that they want to know what's, commercial radio products where they want to know what's going on. But, I didn't go to sleep because quite a group of people are huddled around firing questions. So, as I said, my goodness, they're the thirst for knowledge. We got one of the things that I heard a couple of times was that the TechNet usually is very interesting, but occasionally you guys get on some very boring subjects that I've heard before. And bear in mind that John KC2WGB and I, we do not, for the most part, plan what the subject matter is going to be. The subject matter, be it interesting or boring, is a function of what you guys ask. So if you want more interesting subjects, you have to ask more interesting questions. The only person who has a planned response is Paul WS2N with our space report. So he knows what's coming, so to speak, and his are always interesting. In fact, tonight you're going to be hearing a lot about the Juno spacecraft, which tomorrow night, at a little after 11 p.m. local time, goes into a very critical maneuver. After years of getting on site, and it's moving something like 120,000 miles an hour compared to the Earth. Earth is moving 66,000 miles an hour around the Sun, so that speed gets added. You know, and Earth is right now in its orbit moving away from Jupiter. So therefore you get this huge speed difference between us and Juno. Let me drop. But if you go to the Light NASA website tomorrow night a little after 11 p.m., you'll be able to watch all the nail biting of all the NASA scientists, because that spacecraft is, I think, 48 minutes or something like that, at the speed of light, talking to it one way. If you see it starting to do the wrong thing, by the time you send it a command, you're 48 minutes behind the clock, if you know what I mean. The event is already over. The very critical maneuver is it has to do a burn in order to get into Jupiter orbit insertion, JOI they call it, a 35-minute blast of its main rocket engine. That main rocket engine has to blast for 35 solid minutes in just the right direction in order to slow down, in order to get in orbit. If it doesn't do that, it's just going to do a flyby. It'll be using Jupiter as a gravity assist. It'll exit Jupiter's field even faster than it entered as far as a gravity assist type thing. So that's a very critical maneuver. It's all done by computer. And they're going to be biting their nails to make sure they get everything set up just right. They're going to speed up its rotation to make sure it's got more gyroscopic action to make sure it blends for 35 minutes in just the right direction. So that's an exciting thing coming up. Let it drop. Last week, John, KD2IXP, signed in, got on my list. But we didn't get to him right away, so he had to get his beauty sleep, and he wasn't there. Therefore, he's going to be high on our list this week, because he's a carryover from last week. The way the TechNet runs, as you guys have heard so often, is that we take check-ins with people who do have a question or a comment. They give me their call letters, their name, and the word yes, which means you got a question or a comment, and we take those in order. Approximately an hour or so is spent in that mode, depending on how exciting and how many questions. Sometimes it goes beyond that. The timing here is only vague. It doesn't have to be exact. After that, it's followed by John, KC2WGB, with the mailbag, meaning people who communicate with John because they don't yet have the ham license, don't have the right equipment to talk to us, and they've got a question. We take a few of those that are of general interest. Let me drop.
Steve, with the quickie answers.
And along the way, Hal, K6 Delta Papa Zulu, will from time to time give us the more brief answers because I'm kind of verbose. At least Hal thinks so. He's not alone. Then that's followed by Paul, WS2N, with our space report. So that's the schedule. And as I said, we got lots of compliments by all of these people gathered around when I was at each one of these field day sites. So I guess I got to do more of that. But my goodness, there were such phenomena that wherever I went, there was a considerable gathering. As I sat in a chair or went to a picnic table, so to speak, people would gather around. And how they knew who I am, I'm not quite sure about that, because my picture doesn't appear in very many places. I guess it does on the two Mike and Mike websites accompanying the TechNet. You've got website number one by Mike, K1MJM. And that's Mike. Here we go. Yeah. KC2NJI is mic number one. That web
repeater, timeout.
Yeah, mic number one is KC2NJI, Mike Perry in New Jersey. And if you go to his website, which is amateurradio.tangovector, www.amateurradio.tangovector, choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and there are 10 solid years of TechNet all recorded. So if you can't stay up so late, there's various ways you can download that into your listening device and play it at some other time. Another website is mic number two, K1MJM, which is limartechnet.com. Both of these websites have got accompanying information, photographs, pictures of antennas, the so-called Brown and Woodward curves that I talk about so much for assessing what an antenna does when you're off frequency. So lots of information is there that complements the TechNet. So at this time, we're going to take check-ins from people who do have a question or comment. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, because I'm so forgetful, and the word yes, because you do have a question or comment. K2RIW, TechNet, Lima, listening. Okay, so nobody signed in this week. We're going to close down the TechNet and see you guys next week. K2RIW, listening.
GXM.
Okay, I think that was Whiskey 2 Golf Sierra Mike, and what I just said obviously was a joke. To GSM and Rich, and did I get your call letters correct, Rich? Go ahead.
Dick, unfortunately, I'm using
Valve on again. Yeah, the RF is a little bit weak, but sounds good. Audio is a little bit low, so you're going to have to eat the mic and talk loud. We're hearing you very well, but typical of Balfongs. I've been doing some experiments with various Balfongs, and there must be a huge number of different model numbers you can buy. And I'm discovering that some of them come with full modulation. Unfortunately, one of the most popular ones. Can't even think of the model number. Stand by.
I want to make a question from last week.
Yeah, the UV5R. UV5R is the one where a significant percentage of them are very narrow, even when they're in the wideband mode. Eric, you want to make a correction? Go right ahead. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah,
I did actually say that no LEDs were sort of like the big LEDs. Well, actually, it's really not. It has an emissive electroluminescent layer film, which is an organic film, which is a little bit different than what I described.
Pretty fine, Eric. It's taking me 15 years, approximately, to abandon my cathode ray tube, 33-inch, I think it is, conventional television set, which had a Radio Shack converter box on top to receive digital television for the next few years. I finally abandoned that and went and got a real digital television, just went and got something. But obviously, with my resources and with your suggestions as to who makes a good one, I should buy a better one. The Vizio I bought is okay, but it's got a number of glitches that I don't care for, a number of not quite user-friendliness, but ways of operating. All right, so far when it comes to sign-in, for people who do have a question or a comment, we got Rich. Anyone else to sign in because you do have a question or a comment? And maybe a little bit later on, I'm going to ask you now that you've slept up a little bit from all of that drastic exercise of field day last week, you can sign in and give me an impression of what your field day site that you visited or what you participated in, what it was like from your point of view. Field day is the high holy days of ham radio, apparently. It's in the United States one of the most attended events among the VHF operators. Of course, it's the August UHF contest, June and September VHF contest, the January sweepstakes, or whatever it's called. So there's a number of other contests for the VHF, UHF operators, but they're a slightly rarer breed compared to the real guys, most of the real operating went on HF. Although the field day sites these days are starting to use a significant amount more of 2 meters, 220 and 432 and 1296, so they're realizing those upper frequencies are not just for the eggheads. So we got Rich that signed in so far. Anyone else who does have a question or a comment for the TechNet, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
WS2N is here with the Space Report. I have a Vizio. It's a great TV, Dick.
KC2WGB with a question for Eric.
John recognized. Okay, Paul first. You probably went and bought the Cadillac Vizio. I was at a computer store, can't even think of the name of it, and I bought one that's on sale, a bottom basement price, and I probably bought the bare bones unit that has none of the features. Roughly, what's the size of your screen, and roughly what was the price of yours, Paul? If you like it so much, you must have bought a much better one than I did. WS2N, K2RIW.
I've probably got it about at least 5 years now, so it's not the LED backlighting, it's the LCD. They're all LEDs, but you have the LCD. It's probably these, I'm going to guess, fluorescent tubes in the back, before the new ones came out. So it's a bit heavier. The new ones I think I could probably pick up the weight of three to compare to the one I have. 32 inches. It does everything I could imagine that you could do with it. So I don't know what features that you're missing. But, mine works on everything. I've even hooked it up to the antenna. Give that a try. But now it's disconnected. I just haven't hooked up the cable. All my other CRT TVs are hooked up to the antenna. And they work good. Back to you, Dick.
I wonder if yours is a plasma screen, Paul. And one of my complaints is that compared to the Radio Shack set-top box, which gives you lots of information on the screen as to what's playing and who is it, where does it come from, and what is the next program coming up next, is displayed on the Radio Shack digital display unit. My Vizio doesn't give me anywhere near as much information, and the information it gives me on the screen is in microtype. I have to literally use binoculars in order to be able to read the screen. unless I'm 5 feet from the screen, the typing is so small that I have to use binoculars. So you've got an earlier unit, probably with bigger display information, and I wonder if yours is a plasma or a screen pole.
Repeater, timeout.
WS2N, K2RI, WGN pole, wait for the beep, I didn't.
Yeah, copy that. No, it's a regular, you know, LCD screen. It's not plastic. But now they're all lightweight. They're all, what is it, LED lit in the back, you know, for the lighting. Mine is probably the fluorescent tubes that they had. So theoretically, I could go 50,000 hours. I don't watch that much TV. So I guess it's probably going to outlive me. 32 inch, that's all I want. I didn't want a gigantic thing. I don't want my eyes going back and forth, left and right. That becomes annoying. I'd rather just stare at one screen. I don't want to say to my wife, well, what's going on over there on the left? You know, I'm not watching that part of it. I'd rather just look straight ahead. sound is great. What more can you ask for, you know? And I even hooked up a sound bar for last, but I very seldom use that. I really don't need that. Thank you, sir.
I should know, but Eric's going to have to tell me. On my one-year-old Vizio, 33-inch, 32-inch, whatever it is, what do you believe is the source of lighting on that screen? Do you think it's a fluorescent tube, or do you think it's a light-emitting source? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2RW, K2J, more than likely it's a fluorescent tube. Although, how thick is your screen? Because they have actually got literally white LEDs. But there's lots of it because, you know, the fluorescent tube should be made long. The length of your screen, they pack a whole bunch of them to give you even illumination. And there's a thin piece of opal glass behind you. Or rather, in front of it, behind the LCD, to not allow you to see the highlights of the tube when light falls off.
Yeah, bear in mind that my screen contains all the electronics, the RF video computer, as well as lighting and display. I would estimate the screen is in the vicinity of 2 inches thick, Paul. Does that give you a hint that most likely I've got a cold cathode, fluorescent tube? Over to you, Eric.
More than likely. The fact that the electronics are packed in, you know, when it comes to the surface mount stuff, it's amazing how thin they can make it. But they also have a tendency to the bottom edge and at the top edge, they'll put little PC boards at kind of an angle. Some of them are actually on flexible PC boards. They think they sell. But more than likely, if you paid in like the hundreds of dollars instead of the thousands of dollars, you've got fluorescent tubes.
It's about 3.5 inches thick there.
Wow. Yeah, mine's a little thinner than that. I guess that makes it lighter. One other quirk that this Vizio has, Eric, is that about once per month, maybe once per 3 weeks, it goes into a lockup mode where the remote control does nothing. Can't make it move, can't do anything with it. You have to unplug it from the 110-volt line and reboot the thing, and then it comes back to life. So the computer in there goes into some kind of a hang-up mode about once a month or once every 3 weeks. Over to you, Eric, for any comment on that.
Just out of curiosity, does your set have a Ethernet connector on it?
Yes, it does, and you're not going to ask me, did my son connect it to Ethernet, and I think he did. So there's ways he can pick up stuff from the Ethernet, Internet, or whatever, and display it on the screen. I don't know how to do that, but I've seen him do it. Over to you, Eric. So that could be a contributing factor to the occasional hang-up. Maybe my TV set's being hacked. Over to you, Eric.
Well, more than likely, Vizio is aware of the problem, and they have a software upgrade. Usually, I don't know the Vizio sets that well, but Samsung and others, you can actually go into the menu and find where the latest, you know, what version of software you're running, and if it's an older one, to let you upgrade it.
That sure would be nice. Let me try. sure be nice if that upgraded software give me more information on the screen when I request it, with bigger lettering that can really be read. So I'll have to go look for that. John, KC2WGB, go ahead with your question with Paul. And tomorrow night, 11 o'clock, we should all be watching one of the NASA sites, particularly the end, if you had a satellite receiving system, a television receive-only terminal. There's a particular satellite you can go to, a particular transponder, particular polarization and frequency, and you can watch all the material being transmitted live between the NASA sites as to what they're really seeing with Juno. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Good evening, gentlemen, and everyone on the net. My question was for Eric. Eric, the comment, the correction you made on the organic LEDs. All right, electroluminescence. Is that electroluminescence or bioluminescence stimulated by the electrical impulse?
Well, when I finished that conversation, I scratched my head. I said something wrong. Then I went and looked it up. Well, let me just give you a little quick history. There's a guy that worked for Eastman Kodak. Let me find his name. Dr. Ching W. Tang at Eastman Kodak. The term OLED traditionally refers specifically to this type of device, or the term SMOLED is also. The molecules commonly used in OLEDs include organometallic chelates, used in organic light-emitting dyes reported by Tang, fluorescent and phosphorescent dyes, and conjugated dendrimers. Number of materials used for the charge transport properties, like triphenylamine and derivatives, and commonly used materials as whole transport layers. Fluorescent dyes can also be chosen to obtain light emission at different wavelengths from compounds such as pyrolene, rubin, quinacridone derivatives they often use. So, basically what we're talking about is actual electroluminescent conductive polymer that emits light when ignited by an external voltage. Okay, let me let it drop for a second. They're used as a thin film for full spectrum color display. Polymer OLEDs are quite efficient and require relatively small amounts of power. That's why OLEDs are great outdoors, because they produce a tremendous amount. There's different compounds and side chains of polymers that can be used to change the frequency at which it operates. So, go on and on and on, there's a lot of stuff here. But the interesting part about it is, lately, DuPont claims that they can print a large screen in about 2 minutes using a jet-type printing thing. And Sony is actually making displays on a flexible piece of plastic. There's more to it than that, but that should cover it. Back to you, John.
Thank you for that information. So basically it is electroluminescent. Very nice. Okay, thank you. Back to you, Dick.
I have the impression from what you've been telling us over the last few years, Eric, that a tremendous amount of research is going into display devices. We've come a long way from great, big, heavy, huge chunks of glass with high vacuum called the cathode ray tube. We've come a long way. And the most severe environment I can think of for a display is the instrument panel of an aircraft. When you're flying to 10,000 feet, you've got a whole lot of bright sunlight and ultraviolet pouring into the window, and your Garmin radio that's trying to give you a navigation and communication equipment capability, that screen on that front panel, what in the world do they use for that display so that it can still be seen with high enough visibility to keep the pilot happy at high noon with the sun that's shining in at 10,000 feet? KE2EJ, K2IW, how does Garmin do that, Eric?
The Garmin stuff, for a long while now, they've been making OLEDs, like most of your cell phones, the OLEDs, you know, your smartphones, you can see them. But they did make some, in 2007, a while back, say, created experimental LED, today more common, which sustained 400 cd per square meter of luminance for, and it lasts 190 hours for green, 1,000 hours for blue. By the way, the downside of the OLED is its lifespan, and the blue OLEDs have a much shorter lifespan than the green LED. But today's screens, you're looking about 25,000 to 40,000. Full brightness. The thing after that is like half brightness, so you've got a life.
I think 24 hours a day, you've got something like 8,000 hours per year. So I guess we can divide that and say that even if you leave it on 24/7, you're good for something like 5 years on those displays. Is that roughly true, Eric?
Now, that's the thing that you should calculate that. Back at the main station, you got a bunch of OLEDs that were made by Sony, and bought a couple of them about 6 years ago, and it's now becoming time to replace the screen. Actually, they made it so that you can actually replace the screen to keep your product, so you don't have to go buy a whole new monitor.
So if I understand you, at your television studio, one of your key monitors, the screen is starting to get dim, and blue is not as bright as red and green, and you're starting to see that failure mechanism coming about. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. But Sony was smart about it, and they actually have a probe that you put on the surface of the screen, and you run this little software that's built into the set, and it actually makes the correction, the color balance of the other two colors to give you the correct color imagery when you're looking at it, although it is not nearly as bright as it used to be.
In the early days of cathode ray tubes, the red phosphor was the one that was much lower in efficiency, so I believe the actual beam current out of the cathode of the cathode ray tube was considerably higher on the red beam compared to the green and blue beam. Do you remember those days, Eric? I bet you do. KQIW.
Absolutely. In the beginning, they had an awful lot of fun trying to read what we call a PIE tube, the color imagery. Whereas if you went and... Now, I'm sure when you were fixing color TVs and you were doing the 22AXP4, you know, that was a tube with the metal body connected to the neck. When you went and did the purity adjustment, the red didn't really kind of look red. It was sort of an orange, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. And I think there have been cathode ray tubes and maybe even solid-state displays where they have more than three colors, not just red, green, blue. I think they also include
yellow.
As I was about to ask, I presume when you add the yellow, does that overcome some of the deficiency of the exact wavelength, so to speak, you're getting out of your other so-called primary colors? Therefore, there are certain colors and brightnesses on the screen. When you've got yellow, you can do a better job. What does yellow buy you, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, at first, it was really kind of a... Sharp was the one that came out with it. Got an improvement in luminance, but don't forget, yellow is made from green and blue, get your yellow in additive, not subtractive like in pink. You actually are able to improve in terms of skin tone because of the mixture of green, get a little more brightness out of it, but it requires, you know, a little bit of a funky demodulator to make it all work together. But specifically, in terms of red, I don't think that was their goal.
Of all the colors that can be displayed on a display device, I think pink represents a difficult one to produce with high fidelity. I think flesh tones are hard to produce. And so, depending on the exact wavelengths involved, making flesh tones and pink are kind of difficult, and I guess the higher value, the more expensive sets probably do a better job of each of those. Eric, go ahead. K2LIW in the tech net.
Now, once you get away from CRTs and the phosphates, color imagery is far superior than what you get out of it. the CRT. Although, I've got to admit, you know, I've got the broadcast monitors with the CRTs, the phosphor mix to them, the rare earth material, which they tend not to use in the consumer stuff, so that makes them a little more expensive. But with the, you know, IMQ demodulator, two active demodulators, and matrixing it out, because don't forget, even today, it still matrixed out. The actual colorimetry was more real because the specifics of the spectrum of red, green, and blue, when you add them together and you get a pure white, the rare earth phosphors did a much better job of doing it at higher levels of luminance, you know, higher actual white output. But in the world of LCDs and OLEDs, you don't run into that problem as much.
There's an awful lot going on with human color perception. That human color perception is not obvious. Your retina has cones and rods. The rods are the black and white, very sensitive detecting devices in your retina, which tend to be away from the center of your retina, peripheral vision. Whereas the fovea and the macula, the center of your retina, the high density area, the high accutance area, has a high percentage of cones. The cones come in three flavors, red, green, and blue. Those that sense red, green, and blue, and there are very few human beings that something funny happens genetically where I think they have some yellow cones. So if you take the wavelength of yellow, for instance, it's a particular wavelength of light, and you shine it into a human eye, it creates a certain amount of response of the red cone, because that the red filter, so to speak, it's got some skirts to it. It's not a sharp filter. And a certain amount of response of the green filter, the green cones in your eye. So a certain percentage of response of your red cones and your green cones, the human brain puts it together and says, aha, that's yellow. You look at it with a real optical spectrum analyzer. Yellow is a particular wavelength, and it doesn't contain any red and doesn't contain any blue, any green, per se. But you can fool the eye. And so when you put together three primary light-emitting colors, red, green, and blue, if you looked at it with a optical spectrum analyzer, let me drop it. You would see a line at red, you'd see a line at green, you'd see a line at blue. There's really three frequencies there, three individual frequencies, three individual colors. Shine that into a normal human eye, and the brain says, hey, all three of my cones are equal in response. The brain says that must be white. It doesn't really do a spectrum response like a true spectrum analyzer. So the brain will see white. Real white coming out of the sun is a whole bunch of frequencies. In other words, it's a continuous spectrum. What you see as white from the sunlight is really a continuous spectrum. There's not individual lines in there per se. But you can fool the eye into thinking it sees white by putting three primary colors in there, three sharp bandwidth colors of just the right amplitude. My close to your understanding of how a human eye works, Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KRIW, KE2EJ. Now, forget that in the early days of color TV, RCA did a lot of physiological studies of eyeballs. Rods and cones, or rather the cones, specifically. You look at each one, and they're pretty wide. The bandwidth in which that they are sensitive to is not like 660 nanometers of red. It goes from like 640 to 680 to 690. Same thing with green. Actually, green is wider than red, and blue is much narrower. Sensitivity is adjusted in the brain, so to speak, but those combination appears white. That's another reason we actually took what the eyeball does and translated that into bandwidth that we use in terms of how much space we occupy to carry the information that you need. So in television, we actually have 56% green, 22% red, something like 11% blue. I forget the exact amount, it makes up to the 100%. But to the eyeball, if you take three projectors, a red, green, and blue projector of equal amplitude, and you project them on the wall and you overlap, and with all three overlaps, you see white.
And the actual bandwidth of the cones of a human eye. Kind of broad. The red, the green, and the blue, when you plot their response versus wavelength or versus frequency, there's a lot of overlap halfway between those two colors. The good news is that something coming halfway between the two, because of the overlap, you can see it. There's some real response. And the ratio of those two red and green responses tells you whether or not it's yellow, orange, and so on. Interesting stuff. So far, we've got Rich that signed in, and one last call. Anyone else is going to want their name on the list because they're going to, they've got a question or a comment for the TechNet. Give me your call letters and name right now. K2LIW listening.
K2LIW. John. Yes.
Okay, as I told you, KD2IXP signed in last week, and John's going to go very high on the list because he signed in last week. Now, John, your signal is extremely noisy tonight. You are 80% noise, 20% audio. So anything you can do to aim the antenna a little better, give us a little more power. If you're on a handy talkie, move to a better location. I'm going to come back to you right after Rich. And so for everybody to hear your message, it'd be good if you could do something to make it a little stronger. Rich, W2, Gulf, Sierra Mike, the first guy who signed in tonight. What would you like to ask the TechNet people? K2RIW listening.
Thank you, Dick, and the TechNet. This is Rich. Ditch DUV5R on Oboshana. I would like to follow up on a question that was asked 2 weeks ago about solid-state transmit receive switch, and I've been ongoing in my efforts to design a really good solid-state TR switch that will protect high-quality receivers and high transmit. Got the receiver part down pretty well, grounding it, etc. And my question has to do with isolating the transmitter from the receiver circuit while receiving. I understand you have to isolate the transmitter. Let me jump. You have to isolate the transmitter to prevent receiver suck out from the tube high network. And I've seen circuits that do that with lumped constants. And I'm also looking at circuits that do that with PIN diodes, isolating the transmitter from the antenna line when receiving. Don't know exactly how that works or how to design it. But if I get any leads appreciated, any articles, thanks. Golf X3 Mike. Perfect.
Yeah, I think he said he's doing this at HF. And I'm about to ask him about PIN diodes and HF. There's an incompatibility there. So is this an 80 to 10 meter transceiver you're doing this work for, Rich? W2GSM, K2RIW, go ahead.
Yes, Nick, it's totally HF, 80 to 10 meters. And I'm ideally going to be using it with my venerable EastJet 60C transmitter and any good receiver that I decide to hook up to.
Yeah, I'm going to turn it over to Eric in a minute, and when it comes back to you, I'm going to be asking you, what is your motivation? If you use a real coaxial transmit-receive relay, a component that has been around for a zillion years, they're extremely reliable when they're used correctly. To go solid state, the advantage is you can switch a lot faster, and in theory, the circuit is more compact, but it's got some disadvantages. And PIN diodes down at HF frequencies, I think they almost do not exist today. Eric's going to give us more info on that. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Oh, and those frequencies that collapse you really. Unless you want to do QSK, you want to do break and king and that kind of stuff, which really is a little bit slow. PIN diodes are good about 25 megahertz and up. Actually, MACON makes a whole big series of PIN diodes will handle a lot of power. Actually, the forward bias on the PIN diodes is in milliamps, so we have to provide for a DC bias is simple. But even at those frequencies, the best way is to use a quarter wave device at the way you design the circuit, where
when your receiver actually looks like it's looking into as low as it's open, what you would have to do is you would use multiple diodes. You would use one and bias it so that that part, that input of the receiver is actually grounded. And the transmitter side is looking into a quarter wave line. And through the quarter wave line, the diode that's sitting on the quarter wave line looks into something that looks like an ion piece. It looks like an open. The receiver side looks like a short. You can use, believe it or not, you can use good old switching diodes if you really want to get fancy. But you could use, you know, a 1N4004 on the transmit side, it'll work fine. Actually, if you want to see there's a YouTube video by W2AW where he goes through all the different kinds of switching circuits that are currently used in many of the different transceivers, and he explains the whole process, so you might want to look that up. W2AEW, and you can search for SYN diodes, or switching diodes, and...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, we lost the last 10 seconds, Eric, because of timeout. If the PIN diodes you know of start at 20 megacycles and go up, my guess is those PIN diodes are not going to be so happy operating at 160 meters. So there you're going to be...
Oh, period.
I think you're going to be using conventional diodes and pouring enough current into them so that the peak RF current of the transmitter does not exceed the bias current. Is that approximately what's done, Eric? Over to you, Eric.
Even with a conventional silicon diode, the forward current that you're doing is still going to be a milliamp, so that's really not so much an issue, because in essence, the RF that you're passing through it, that's a little bit different than a PIN diode. PIN diode is much easier about it, but yeah, I think what you're saying is about right.
Just to round out the numbers, Eric, let's assume that I've got 50 watts coming out of the transmitter going into a 50 ohm line. 50 watts is 50 volts RMS, which means it's really hitting 70 volts peak, and 1 ampere RMS, which really means it's hitting 1.4 amperes peak. If I was using a fast switching diode, which can respond to frequencies like 160 meters, 1.8 megahertz, and if I'm not pouring 1.5 amperes of current into that diode, then on the peaks of the RF, the diode is becoming an open circuit, and it's going to be a harmonic generator. KE2EJ, K2RAW in the TechNet.
K2RAW, K2EJ. If the diode becomes an open, then yes, it's going to become a harmonic generator. But if you've got the... depends upon the way you put it into the circuit. If you're using it as a passive device, so you'll be using a power diode, not a switching diode. A switching diode is not going to be able to handle that kind of current. In that case, with a PIN diode, it's a whole different animal. You would have to use a power diode. You can use a conventional rectifier that's like a 1 amp 4001.
Yeah, for people who are listening to this and want to know what is a PIN diode, PIN, positive, intrinsic, negative, it's a way of intentionally making a very sloppy, slow diode, where the diode is so slow in its response, by slow I mean microseconds, as opposed to a real fast diode, which we can switch from short to open in picoseconds. So if you make a sloppy, slow diode, it doesn't see the RF. And so pins do that job very nicely, where you don't have to put a huge amount of current. But when you've got, in my example, a 50-watt transmitter, which is producing 50 volts RMS at 1 ampere into your 50-ohm line, and then your switching diodes have to tolerate that 1 ampere, which is really 1.414 amps peak on the positive half cycle, so to speak. And you don't want the diode, if it's a fast diode, to be coming an open circuit during portions of that waveform and generating all kinds of crazy harmonics. It can then start becoming what's called a step recovery diode, where it intentionally makes a whole comb of frequencies that would show up on your spectrum analyzer. Let me drop this. Now, in this website by W2 Alpha Echo Whiskey, W2AEW, does he show a number of solid-state switching networks for 100-watt, let's say, class of transmitters, 160 through 10 meters, maybe even beyond 62 meters? Does he show a number of circuits, Eric, that have real history, real track record, been used in real rigs, and has known amounts of isolation where you're not going to be creating damage to the receiver by leakage from the transmitter, and you're not going to be creating a whole lot of desensitivity of the receiver because of insertion loss of the switching network? And as I said before, the great advantage of a switching network made out of solid state is, in theory, it can be made very fast. We can be doing packets and full break-in and maybe even the new digital modes, the Motorola digital modes, maybe you can do that with the switching diode. So do you believe that the circuits presented there, Eric, is one of the best locations where Rich can go and find circuits that are have a good track record, known good history of doing the job? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, he does. He demonstrates, actually shows you the circuit, I think it's a Kenwood, he gives you transceiver, it's 100 watts, and he shows the diode switching and how that operates there, and then he goes on to show pin diode operation at higher frequencies.
In his presentation, Eric, does he tell you the amount of receiver isolation that the network is giving? You'd like to have at least 30 dB of isolation, in my opinion. In other words, if the transmitter is running 100 watts, which is plus 50 dBm, 30 dB of isolation means that there's still 20, plus 20 dBm getting into the receiver. That's 100 milliwatts. Depending on the design of the receiver, it might be able to tolerate 100 milliwatts of transmit power without creating damage. So does he report isolation numbers, KE2EJ, K2RIW?
I believe he does. Actually, I'm going to look it up. I'm going to do it in a minute. But he also shows you that it's a dual switch. One switch shorts the input to the receiver through a quarter wave line, and other switch switches the transmitter to the antenna connection. So yeah, he goes through that whole process.
You remember that the early computer guys, they used to say things like, smart people borrow, geniuses steal, when it comes to other people's circuits. Rich, I'm pretty sure that you're diligent enough that if you're willing to pull your hair out and go through various testing procedures, you will be able to come up with your own design for solid-state switching. In this experience, in this situation, my strong recommendation is you steal somebody else's design that has a known track record. Because when you look at that circuit that's in a full production transceiver, 100-watt transceiver, in theory, the engineer who designed that circuit had to pull his hair out for a couple of weeks to get all the bugs out of it, to make it work right and be reliable. There's a lot of art and science to doing what you're doing. And so there's a minefield out there where there's a zillion ways. Let me drop this. There's a zillion ways that the circuit could end up not doing quite exactly what you want. So you want to try start off with a circuit that's got a known good track record. That's my recommendation. And is your major motivation for designing your own solid-state switch, is it because you want more compact, faster switching speed? You intend to be using digital modes? What's your motivation for doing this? It's a bit of an unusual requirement you've got there. You're pushing the state-of-the-art down from my point of view, Rich. W2GSM, K2RIW in the deck band.
Thank you, Dick. Actually, apologies. My motivation for doing this is to full break-in EW vintage transmitter, and it's a kind of a Frankenstein thing, but I love the DX60B, and I'm trying to get that thing to do full. And as much as you guys are my heroes, I guess W2AEW will be added.
Yeah, it's the W2AEW number 200. It's a TI switching with pin diodes and lumped element quarter wave transmission lines. There's another one which is just switching diodes. I'll get you the number for that one.
I'm guessing, Eric, that you found W2AEW because you recently went through a considerable effort. We're taking some brick-like amplifiers and giving them the ability to do fast switching in order to accommodate the Motorola digital modes. Is that true, Eric? Is that how you got into this?
No, W280W is my Tektronix salesman, and he, just as a hobby, has this whole series of YouTube videos and various different things, it's 130, pin diode, third order, intermodulation, distortion, 118, or number 82. How to use a diode as a switch, switches, and he goes through the whole thing. He explains the differences between them, why you use a quarter-wave lumped element, and how that provides isolation, and he also shows the effects of as you bias the diode, how it passes. And yeah, the amplifier that I put together for, which actually is working now, for the DMR, I utilized his, I reviewed his video and used that as a basis for creating my own design.
Well, you added your own switching network, transmit-receive switching network with fast operation for DMR, which I believe it goes into transmit and receive cycles at roughly 20 milliseconds each in a continuous sequence. So you did that with I believe it's a brick amplifier, and you said it's now in operation. Sounds to me like you're happy with that operation, and all the switching and windowing worked out just right, Eric. In that 20 milliseconds on and 20 milliseconds off, do you intentionally create a fraction of a millisecond of dead time in between the two so the transmit data and receive data do not overlap? KE2EJ, KE2LIW, and the TechNet.
Now, the diodes that I used, the K time is in microseconds, so, it's 20 milliseconds on, 2 milliseconds off, 4 milliseconds on, 2 milliseconds off, 20 milliseconds on, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, run that back again, Eric. I assumed up till now that DMR runs 20 milliseconds on and 20 milliseconds off between transmit and receive function continuously in order to be creating a kind of quasi-full duplex. Are you telling me that there really is some kind of sequence of on and off timing that is or isn't repetitive depending on what service you're doing and what mode you're in? Yeah, give me a few words on to where those various times come from and where they're used. KE2EJ, KE2LIW.
KE2LIW, KE2EJ. First of all, you have to remember, in order for DMR to work, you have to sync it up to the repeater or the station that you're talking to. And so the transmitter makes you transmit a 20 millisecond acting note. When you first hit the button, you're transmitting 4 milliseconds first, which wakes up the repeater. The repeater returns back with a 20 millisecond packet, and that's your 20 milliseconds off. And then it goes, you transmit 20 milliseconds, and it listens for 4 milliseconds for the repeater, passing data back to you, which will be the ID of the station that's operating. There's also some other stuff that's packed in there. The reason why it's 20 milliseconds is you've got to be able to pass audio, and the audio is going to be stuffed into that 20 millisecond packet. The data is really quick, so you only need a small packet. So it's a 20 millisecond on, 2 milliseconds off, a 4 millisecond reverse, a 2 milliseconds off, a 20 millisecond, another big packet. And it works in that order because you've got the first packet being what they call slot 1, and the second 20 millisecond packet will be slot 2, and then back to slot 1, slot 2, with the reverse transmission in between. That's 4 milliseconds away.
GBG.
Sabotai, GBG. We'll get to you in a minute. Eric, what is the bit rate during the 20 milliseconds, which is digital audio? And can that digital audio be continuous so that a person listening to it doesn't notice any interruption? Also, in some kinds of packet systems, if you fail the cyclic redundancy code, bit error rate,
repeater, timeout.
If the didn't get through correctly, if there was error, there's ways that the receiver can say, please resend that last packet. Does DNR have any of that capability, or if errors start happening, do you just get gaps in the audio? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. DMR does not do AUXQ. Then Reed Solomon, and something else. I have to look it up, I can't remember exactly. But it will not ask for another packet. Don't forget, we're talking about a compression where the way DMR is, as opposed to P25 and the Fusion and D-Star, where is the bit rate in DMR, in the end, when you put it all together, is something around 3,200 to 3,600 baud, whereas that, let's say Fusion is a full 9,600 baud in terms of audio. So, yeah, what happens is the audio starts to break up for DMR.
Now, somebody gave us three letters of a call sign, at least that's what we heard. Who was that? Please give me the full call and your name, and proceed with your question or comment. Over to you, sir, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Okay, the name here is Joe, KC2UBG in Deer Park County, and just wanted to talk about the digital modes that you've been talking about for quite some time, which are excellent topics to talk about. There is D25, there is DMR, there is Char and Fusion, and all the types of many things. The DMR that you were talking about does have a form of error correction on the TDMA solution that is presented. With Fusion, you're in DSTAR, you're looking at something called an FDMA, which is frequency between time differentiation and frequency distillation, and that's a big difference in what actually happens.
Hey, Paul, let me drop.
By the way, the error correction in DMR is it's got FEC, it's got Reed Solomon, and the protected data is half rate and three quarter rate for the FEC. So, and FEC stands for forward error correction.
So from that, Eric, could I make a guess that a certain percentage of error in a DMR communication circuit can be tolerated? The forward error correction allows the receiving system to reconstruct the original message, even though some of those bits are corrupted or missing. And so, up to a certain bit error rate, the receiving person will still hear what he thinks is quasi-clean audio and not know that there's gaps or distortion in it because of the forward error correction. Is that approximately true, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, Dick.
But if you go beyond some critical number of error rate, all of a sudden the whole thing comes crashing down. I had the impression, Joe, that you have been using digital modes for some time. I wonder what bands you've been doing it on. 2 meters, 432, 450, and so on. So, it may be on HF. So, of all those digital modes you mentioned, how many have you used? How long have you been using them? And what percentage of the hams on Long Island are up to your speed? KC2, Uncle Golf Bravo, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Quickly, I made an error. Not 4 milliseconds. The sync packet or the embedded signaling is 5 milliseconds. Not 4.
Oh, I was going to call you on that. Please, then I'll tell you another. Go ahead, Joe.
KC2BG. Yep, there is many solutions of those kinds of digital modes, either for ham radio or for commercial. There is tremendous amounts of information I've been gathering since maybe 8 years of DSTAR when it originally came out, and that was FDMA, and the differences is great differences. I mean, I can go on to meet a simplex with either Fusion or either DSTAR, which is FDMA, and go far great distances, far better than, say, TDMA, even if I'm on the same band, on the same frequency. Understand that has no error correction on DSTAR, which is greatly disappointing a lot of people, because sometimes when you get into it, it digitizes for many reasons, but one of the reasons is that it doesn't have bit error correction. And the other solution, which is Fusion, does have a little bit of an error correction, so that's where everybody goes crazy over. It also has more bandwidth to spare, but the thing I want to throw into a curveball is P25, the Magic P25, or Astro P25, and this is what uses both EDMA and FDMA at the same time.